The following program was pre-recorded. On WFAN, it's time for Hello, My Name is Craig, our weekly candid conversation about gambling addiction. It's supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER. Now, here's Craig Carton.
Good morning. Welcome to another edition of Hello, My Name is Craig. Appreciate you spending 30 minutes of your weekend with us. As you know, this is an opportunity to have an open, frank, honest conversation about gambling addiction and gambling addicts. As always, joined by Dan Trillaro with IC360. And joining us this morning, our guest, Gene. Gene, good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you, Craig.
And where in the country are you calling us from?
Well, I'm calling you from North Carolina, but I live in New Jersey.
Got it. How long has it been since your last wager?
I last placed a bet in the middle of October of 2016, wow. But I entered recovery in March of 2019.
Got it. So you kind of did it on your own for a little while and then decided to join the fraternity and sorority of men and women who maybe need some help from time to time and certainly want to be a part of a growing cause of people that, you know, want to share their stories to pay it forward. Congratulations on the amount of time you've now spent without gambling. Very proud of you for that.
Thank you. Thank you. And the same to you.
Thank you. Well, let's tell your story here if we can. How did it all begin? How old were you when you first got exposed to the world of gambling?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I did not come from a family of gamblers. There would be an occasional lottery ticket or an occasional scratch-off. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it was not a gambling family.
Okay.
We were, however, incredibly competitive and known to play lots of games. So I'll come back to that later in my story. I didn't start gambling, though, until I was in my 50s.
Wow. Was there a specific event that took place that lent you to start gambling? Was there like a triple crown race, a big jackpot on a Powerball? What was the event that made you suddenly gamble for the first time?
A casino opened relatively close to where I lived.
Hmm.
And I thought, you know, let me give it a shot. You know, let me go have fun. I didn't treat it as anything more than a night out. And those nights out over a couple of years became closer, more frequent, and never ending.
So you would say, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, that your start of gambling to becoming a compulsive gambler was an evolution, was gradual, took years for that to ultimately take place, or no?
But, well, I think it was a condensed period of time. Between 2009 and 2014. So
Okay. That's
not a long period of time to go from, once every quarter maybe to daily. You know, it was a pretty quick progression.
And what was your game of choice when you physically sat inside a casino?
Stupid. My game of choice were slots. Why? Because I really liked playing cards with my family, and I did not want to taint what I did at home. How's that?
Well, that's fascinating. That level of thought going into what you're going to gamble and where, that fascinates me. So you go in, it's fun, it's recreational, having a good time, and then you kind of feel the urge to go again, and all of a sudden, like you just said, you go from three, four times a year. Were you literally going to the casino every day at the height of your gambling?
I was. I had my own. I want to add something else to that. It was, the proximity certainly was the catalyst towards gambling. But I had been at that point a single mom for a little more than 10 years. I had my own business, that all of the work of that fell on my shoulders. There were some family issues going on that I felt burdened by, and I really suffered from codependency, where I could not say no. So what I found at the casino was that I could escape and shut things off, and nobody bothered me.
Well, Dan, let me bring you in here. We've talked a lot in the years of this show about how many people, myself included, I think you did as well, Dan, after 9/11, use gambling as that, cocoon of safety where you don't have to deal with other people. You could process your emotions in a different manner. And there was a tangible sense of just feeling better while in action. And that's what she's describing.
You know, Gene, it's great to have you on. Yeah, it's almost as if the clouds were kind of building on the horizon for a while. You know, we talk about those personality traits or warning signs. You know, you owned your own business, but you're competitive. You're a risk taker. You know, you were a single mom. You grew up gambling with the family, so it's a fun form of entertainment. Didn't really see the negatives to it. And then you have proximity and accessibility, and all these things come together at a certain time where I just need to escape. You know, I can relate to escaping just like Craig just said. You know, I escaped all the time. I escaped to the thing that made me feel better and that I didn't have any negative consequences with in the past. So I thought, what's the harm? It's a fun form of entertainment. And slot machines, it's easy to get just immersed in that world. Click after click, you know, spin after spin. So it makes perfect sense how it kind of all transpired.
Gene, and the more I you know, listen to what Dan just said, and, you know, you're starting to tell us your story here as well. You know, my knowledge of slots, and I've never played slots a day in my life, but my understanding of slots is it's not a quick in and out. Like, it's a time commitment. When you go there, your plan is to sit on your rump for however long it takes to walk out with nothing, or maybe get fortunate enough to hit a jackpot, right?
Yes. Although, somewhere in my last year of gambling, I knew I was never walking out with any money. I lied to myself, most of all, that I was not going to spend more than what I brought in, which was, you know, of course, a big lie.
Right.
But I knew that if I hit, it was going back in because it was about just staying in action. I didn't care.
So as a single mom and a business owner, I'm going to make the obvious leap that you started using business funds to cover your personal gambling. Now, you own the business, so that doesn't have to be illegal or even immoral. But give me an idea financially of how you...
Oh, it got worse than that, Craig.
Tell me.
I had access to some other people's money. In my last year and a half of gambling, I took advantage of that. Of course, I was always going to put it back. I was going to hit. You know, it was going to go back. And I eventually went to prison.
Wow.
For my gambling. Well, not for gambling. I went to prison for stealing. We all know gambling is legal. But, yes. So I ended up with a prison sentence because of it.
All right, so let's get into that a little bit, if you don't mind. How long were you stealing money? What type of money are we talking about? And then ultimately, we'll get into how people discovered what was going on. But walk me through the frequency and the amounts and that sort of thing.
Okay, so I just want to talk about Dan's point for a minute. Mm-hmm. I have 35 years in another 12-step program. There was a piece of me that thought that I would be immune to another addiction. Like there was, you know, some of that subtlety there that, you know, this won't get me. This is fun. When I started, you know, I didn't think that could ever become a problem.
Right.
So what happened was I was an accountant. I was a person who did a lot of financial advice for people. I've heard a couple of your podcasts that other people have said similar things. I'm very good at helping other people with their finances. What I wasn't necessarily good at was resisting the sob story. Oh, we'll pay you when. We'll pay you this. You know, I just got divorced. I don't have a lot of money now. And I still helped people. I'm not blaming other people for this. I'm just saying that was part of my personality.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was good at my business, I wasn't necessarily successful. So the beginnings of other people's money was to make payroll, was to do some other things. And then the gambling was getting heavier at the same time. So it was a two-edged street.
So you're borrowing other people's money without their knowledge to gamble, in addition to some other things to cover expenses, all with the thought process of, you know, get some more clients, have a good week, et cetera, whatever the case may be. I'm not stealing their money. I'm going to give their money right back. They'll never even know about it. No harm, no foul. And then obviously at some point, somebody found out.
Yes. The hole was way too deep. It was not going back. It was found out. I was investigated. The you know, and rightfully so, I had taken other people's money that did not belong to me to the tune of approximately $300,000 till it was all said and done.
Got it. And no ability to pay that back at the time either, I assume.
No. Not, well, I paid back what I could.
Right.
But I, you know, no. Not,
so now, did the victims of this pursue legal action against you, or once the government found out, did they just take the ball and come after you?
No, it was by victim reporting that the government came.
Got it. And how long was your sentence?
It was a 7-year sentence.
Wow.
With 10 concurrent years of probation. So I am still on probation. So thankfully my parole is over.
Wait, so you got a 7-year sentence, and then upon release of prison, you had to do and have to do 10 years of supervised release?
Another 3 years. So the 10 years was concurrent with the 7.
Got it. So essentially, like the normal for people is you get out of prison, there's a 3-year period of probation / excuse me, supervised release. So that's how they essentially did it for you, but they made it run concurrent with the prison sentence. So either way, it's a long haul. It is a long haul.
And I have, at the time, I have friends. I had friends in the legal, who I had a friend who was a judge, a friend who, you know, several friends who were lawyers, and I couldn't talk to them because they weren't my lawyer. I couldn't go talk to a judge.
Right.
So I felt very isolated not only does gambling isolate us, not only was I feeling isolated because I had all the burdens on me, but then going through the legal process. So when I got the sentence, I just took it. You know, there was some sort of relief about having been caught. I know other people say similar things, not necessarily by the legal system. There was some sort of relief. The judge said the sentence. I took it. But I have come to learn that it was an incredibly harsh sentence for my crime.
Right.
And as I sit in the rooms and I've done research, it seems as if society and the legal system might be a little harsher to women because we're supposed to be more moral or something. I don't know. Let me take
a break right there. We'll continue on with Gene's story and, of course, Dan Chilaro. And this is just another great example of how the addiction takes over rational thought and makes otherwise law-abiding people make decisions that, you know, harm themselves and put them in a situation where, you know, you're willing to give up your freedom for really the better part, if not an entire decade. We'll continue right after this with Hello, My Name is Craig.
Back to more of Hello, My Name is Craig on The Fan with your host, Craig Carton, and supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER.
Welcome back to Hello, My Name is Craig. Dan Chilaro, as always, and Jean, who's nice enough to share her story. Where we left off, Jean, was, you know, a 7-year prison sentence, 10 years of probation, essentially 3 upon release if you had to serve the entire 7 in prison. And I apologize for the sensitivity of this question. You have no money left. You've been ostracized, obviously, by the community. The government's now come after you. And you're looking at serious time. Was there ever a moment in your life when you contemplated, I'm just going to, you know, end it here and not wake up tomorrow morning because that's the easier way out? Or did you not contemplate that?
Thankfully, no. That's not part of my personality. My personality is, you push through it, you do it, you buck up. That's, you know, part of me taking on everybody else's burdens too.
And
I'll do it.
How many years did you actually serve?
Just under 3. So I got out on parole at, just under 3 years, 4 more years of parole, and then 3 years of, on top of that, of probation.
God, so you effectively, after 3 years of sitting in prison, have had to do 7 full years of whatever we want to call it, parole, probation, supervised release. You are still, you know, in some form, you know, a custody In custody of the federal government, yeah?
In custody of the state. Mine was a state sentence.
Your state crime.
So yes. And, you know, with that comes the inability to get a decent job. You know, yep. I certainly couldn't go back to my profession. I ended up working in warehouses at, you know, at the age of 62, doing what I can because, you know, back to, you know, the gambling, I do think I owe these people money back. So, you know, I'm doing what I can. I also have to, you know, support myself and that kind of thing. And only this about 2 months ago did I get my first decent job, and I've been out since 2019.
So it's taken 5 full years for you to get a job worthy of having. And I don't want to diminish, you know, any type of job when you get out of prison. You know, those jobs are entry level jobs, manual labor type jobs, minimum wage type jobs. But you got to do it. You know, there's nothing beneath you at that point. You've served time, and that's the lowest thing, you know, for any of us, because we lose our sense of being a human being when we serve time, because the prison system is not made to make you feel good about yourself. That's for damn sure. Was it when you were away that you started to get the help you needed and talk to other people and stop gambling, or was that a process that started before you went away?
It sort of started before I went away. Interestingly, I asked my attorney whether I should start going to GA meeting, and he said no, that it wouldn't do me any good legally. But I did decide to stop because I didn't think it would look good in front of the judge if my last bet was the day before I walked into court.
Right.
That was the only thing that stopped me. I did not know going in. I was pretty naive about prison. How much gambling occurs in prison.
Right.
It is absolutely the currency of the incarcerated. And I chose not to. It was hard, but I chose not to. And I feel really good about that. I actually feel almost prouder of that than of the time afterwards.
Yeah, it's funny you say
there
that.
Are no-
Yeah. It's funny you said, Gene, and Dan, I'll get your experience here as well. You know, I did my time in a federal prison, not state prison. But, you know, day one, you're asked if, you know, do you want to play cards tonight for money? Do you want to gamble on, you know, football games? They have parlay cards. And I remember I said no politely, no thank you, no thank you, no thank you. And then I didn't get left alone when it came to that until a very powerful guy with an Albanian street gang out of New York told everybody, stop asking him. And because of who this guy was in the prison system, all of a sudden nobody asked me anymore. But the first 6 months that I was there, I was asked on a regular basis, not just to gamble. Then I was asked if I would help guys set lines for games because of my background in sports. And, you know, grace of God, there was a guy that I was away with who took a liking to me or maybe even been a fan of my radio career, who told everybody else, stop asking him. He ain't gambling. And because that guy had the power he had, all of a sudden, overnight, everybody stopped asking me. I'm not sure if you have a similar experience with gambling in prison, Dan, but if so, you'll feel free.
Yeah, I just want to add, Gene, you know, as I listen to your story, I'm listening to my story through you. And I don't know if you know my background, New Jersey, state prison, financial-related crime, illegal retention of assets, prison, and supervised release. Even the way you describe not gambling before going to prison because it would look bad to have your last bet the day before your sentence, those are the exact same thoughts that went through my brain. And when I got to prison, I didn't tell people that I was in there because of a gambling addiction, because I received advice from people in my circle at the time. If I do that, they will not believe me, number one, because nobody steals or embezzles that much money and doesn't have something hiding offshore somewhere. So then I'm going to be constantly harassed. Where's the money? Tell us where it is. And so I had to come up with kind of a different story. And I was approached those first 3 months to bet, set lines, parlay cards, play poker at the table during community time. No. I mean, that was some of the hardest time was to say no to that, because gambling, my relationship with gambling is what put me into the place there I was in prison. And I knew that if I was going to make a difference or change, I could not continue to live that life. Gene, I hear everything you're saying. It's like listening to my story again. It's fascinating.
Gene, walk me through, if you don't mind, only because I'm looking at the clock now, and I know we're going to have to break here in a moment. Walk me through how life is for you now. Obviously, you got this great job, which is awesome, so congrats on that. And while you still owe people money and you're sensitive to that, give us an idea of what life for you is like not gambling. And if you do feel like a lot of us feel, like you've gotten back to who you are at the core of your soul. And I try to explain that to people. You know, the year and a half that I spent really gambling out of control, maybe the 2 years that I did it, I really felt like I wasn't being true to who I really am. And now that I'm not gambling, I feel like I've gotten back to the true sense of who I am as a person. And I wonder if you feel the same way.
Absolutely. You're sort of telling my story. When I was inside, the term I heard was loss of moral compass. Somebody else used that, and I appropriated it and said, absolutely. Like, I suddenly had a word to put to the way I had felt when I was out of control. And I actually carry a little compass with me now on my keychain because that's what I feel. I feel like I'm back. All the things I thought I did well are, you know, are back and part of my life. Just, you know, honesty, willing to really help somebody without looking for something in return. All of that kind of kindness that, you know, what I thought was the person I was, I have not lost. It is back. But I carry my moral compass where I can see it. And that's a good thing.
If I asked you to send a message to people, regardless of age, because you're a bit of an anomaly on guests we've had on this show who didn't gamble till much later in life, your 50s, but still wound up kind of in the same place. A lot of these younger, less mature adults are winding up, you know, a.k.a. in trouble. What is your message to people out there that feel like either they have a problem or maybe they have a loved one that they're concerned about based on your life experience, having given up your freedom and having to start over now in your late 50s, early 60s, what message do you give to people out there that are starting to go down that road?
Don't keep it a secret. If it's a loved one that you think is gambling too much, at least say it to them so that they can, they may not like it, but they're going to register. It's going to be in the back of your head. And if you're the gambler, talk to somebody, because we all know we hit that point where we don't want to gamble anymore. We have to gamble, but we don't like it. And as soon as you can talk about that with somebody openly, I think that's the beginning of making a turn.
Well, look, I'm really proud of you. I'm really glad you decided to come on the show and share, you know, obviously a small portion of your overall story. And I would just say Godspeed to you. Keep doing what you're doing because you're living life, you know, the right way. And there's a reward for that. And we may not get that reward right away, but if you're true to it, if you live your life in a certain manner, those rewards do ultimately come. And I'm glad they're coming for you. And again, thank you so much for sharing your story. It does make a difference, and I hope you continue to share your story with other people. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you, Dan.
You know, listening to her story, you know, I feel for her, obviously. Now, she did bad things, and you know, she did hurt people from a financial sense, and I'm sure an emotional sense as well. But, you know, her story also proves the old adage that it's never too late, you know, to do the right thing. It's never too late to live your life the right way. And she could have given up at 60 years old, and she didn't. And I think there's a lot to be said about that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, she has late onset gambling, right? I mean, just growing up in the family she did and being in recovery from another program she mentioned. And it started late, and it escalated quickly, and it resulted in prison time and then an extended period of time for supervised release. Craig, it also highlights to me the lack, I think, of understanding and the need for more education in the judicial system. Because, you know, when we started warehousing addiction instead of letting people get treatment, it doesn't excuse the behavior by any means. All three of us had that in common on this call today. But I sense that, again, in New Jersey, the push or the encouragement of a gambling treatment diversion court, where we can then let people get the help they need, rehabilitate, go to meetings, make their restitution, and start working through the recovery process outside of those prison walls, in certain cases, when it's okay to do so, it just highlights that discrepancy in sentencing and guidelines.
Yeah, and I feel very strongly that, especially and specifically for first-time offenders, the goal should be to make people whole that aren't whole financially. That should be, to me, the first goal, right? And I think there's a lot to be said about taking people like us and having a diversion program where they can get the help we need for the addiction, but also not take away our ability to earn a living so that we can make those payments and make people whole, you know, quicker than otherwise, you know, the current justice system allows us to. And I know I'm speaking on behalf of the people that, you know, committed the wrongs, but I think if you talk to any of the people in this country that have been financially victimized, whatever the story might be, their only goal, their only hope is to get their money back. The real focus should be on how do we get the addict help and allow them to continue to earn a living so that the victims of their alleged or actual crime, you know, can be made whole as quickly as possible. That should be the goal.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, we have drug court, right? We have a model already where you take people who are convicted of drug-related crimes, nonviolent oftentimes, and you put them back for rehabilitation. And that's the key, right? The stigma associated. And to be honest, Craig, we stole more than just money. Like, I know I needed to go to prison to get well. I stole trust. I stole safety and security from people, and there's no dollar sign on that. So I fully acknowledge that, and I realize I needed to go away. I just think we need better programs and services, either internally or then for people who can avoid or divert from prison back into society to get those jobs, those meaningful jobs, and reduce the stigma and shame around this insidious disease.
Yeah, and I want to make sure I'm being clear about this with Dan. You know, there should be a penalty. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah,
You're right. It's a financial crime. It's emotional. It's mental. People in our lives have been put through. So no one's suggesting that it should be a slap on the wrist and, you know, wish you a good day. But, you know, sending someone to sit in a prison for 7 years and then expect them to also make people whole when you're 62 years old, as much as you want to. Society isn't built around giving a 60-year-old person a job that allows them to pay their own bills and also make proper restitution payments. So the system isn't perfect for sure, and it absolutely can be fixed. Hopefully will give people a better opportunity not just to get back to their own lives, but to do right by the people that they hurt. There's no doubt about that. Well, look, Dan, it's always a pleasure talking to you. We just give people a schedule update. Obviously, as we get into the summer, we'll probably take a couple of weeks off from the show as we move towards the end of June, but we're not going anywhere. Hello, my name is Craig. It's here every Saturday, and we appreciate people allowing us to bring the show into their cars and homes. And remember, if you feel like you got a problem, please pick up the phone. If you have a friend or a relative that you think has a problem, please pick up the phone and reach out to them and start the conversation. And Dan, as always, appreciate your time and story.
Yeah, thank you, brother.
Joe Benigo's next. Continue enjoying your weekend. Lots of baseball right here on WFAN.